This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 1st of April 2014 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Grundig. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design every single week here on Monocle 24. You're here with me, Tom Morris. Coming up today, I talk craft with the co-founder of a leading initiative that's helping elevate the status and line the pockets of craftsmen across the British Isles.
Somebody stood up and said, the problem with the luxury goods industry is it's hijacked the craft industry. And I thought, no, stupid, that's entirely wrong. It's just the craft industry is terrible at marketing itself.
And we profile the best in Brazilian design, old and new, at a new exhibition in London.
Brazil is a very big country, many regions, and the culture is very diversified. And we can find not one specific style.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. The New Craftsman was a venture set up 2 years ago to celebrate the best in craft across the British Isles. It now works with a network of 75 makers, ranging from ceramicists such as Billy Lloyd to leather goods by Doe Leather. And it also counts knitwear, furniture and wooden spoons in its portfolio. What started out as an online venture and pop-up shop will soon have four walls to call its very own. The New Craftsman will open its permanent showroom on May the 15th on 34 North Row, just by Selfridges in London. Mark Henderson was one of the co-founders of The New Craftsman. As chairman of Gieves & Hawkes and a director of Walpole, the UK Luxury Association, he's a man committed to the Made in Britain brand. I caught up with Mark in the studio to discuss The New Craftsman and how it's helping redefine the C-word.
It really was a case of a light bulb going on, actually. At least I hope it was a light bulb and that it's going to produce lots of light. But I spent a number of years working on Savile Row, and I was involved in the setting up of a cooperative company on the row to train people in tailoring and select the right people to do apprenticeships and so on. And as a result, I started mentoring craftspeople. And I was sitting in a room, actually it was the Andaz Hotel in Liverpool, just by Liverpool Street, with a bunch of about 15 people who were earning a living or just earning a living as craftsmen. Some really, really brilliant people. I think Billy Lloyd was there, Deborah Carey and James Ducker, who were the most wonderful shoemakers. And they were sitting explaining how difficult it was to make a living. And I was meant to be mentoring them in what they could do. And the thing that occurred to me was that this wasn't so much about mentoring. This was actually about somebody needed to help them. And that really, people just needed help in selling beautiful craft. And so they're never happier than when they're making things. That's what they do. And you can't be a master of all things. So that was the sort of germ of the idea. And I then spent a couple of years just looking at the whole industry. What's the difference between the way in which craft is marketed rather than art? Why is craft so generally relatively inexpensive, whereas art can be extremely expensive? Why do artists have agents? Why do musicians have agents? Why do writers have agents? But why don't craftsmen have agents? And what should be done about it? So I spent 2 years thinking about it, talking to gallerists, going to see the Craft Council, talking to people who were craftsmen. And out of that came The New Craftsman, and we launched it in December 2012 with a pop-up shop at 5 Carlos Place. Mm. And we sold £48,000 worth of stuff in 18 days. It went like a rocket. And we thought there's the foundation for a business here.
Could you talk us through the breadth of things the craftsmen involved? I mean, there are potters, there are shoemakers, there are furniture makers.
Pretty much we decided that the two areas that we didn't particularly want to work in was fashion and food, because they're perishable. And also because I've been working in the clothing business for some time. And so the areas that we really want to focus on were useful products, if you like, and beautifully made products. So we go literally from Sheffield-made scissors. We have beautiful gold-plated scissors from Ernest Wright, through to glass, through to furniture, through to textiles, and so on. It's really the entire gamut of craft. There is nothing that we don't want to touch.
Mm. And is it specifically designed to help up-and-coming craftsmen, or is it, are we talking about, you know, interesting old men that are sort of...
We'd love to have old masters. So we've had some lovely talks. I mean, we had a wonderful guy from the King's Troop, who's their master saddler, in giving a talk about just hand-making beautiful and maintaining beautiful saddlery, together with a young girl who's set up a leather business, for instance. Mm. So it's, I would say we tend to work with more up-and-coming people than with well-established people, because they're the ones that need the help. But we do have some pretty well-established people as well.
Mm. And what, I mean, taking a more general view, what do you believe the sort of state of British manufacturing is at the moment?
I think there's some real bright spots. I think there's a question about the value of work. When you look at something and you think of the number of hours of work that has gone into it, and then you compare it to something that can be mass-produced in somewhere where you've got very, very low-wage economy, there are certainly many people who just can't be bothered to pay the, won't be bothered to pay the extra. Yeah. So it's how do you value work? But I think there is a growing interest. I mean, if you stop people on the street and say, would you rather buy something that was made in Britain or not? They'll all say, I'd rather it was made in Britain. Mm. And then it's finding a reason for buying something that's made in Britain, because it's better made. And I mean, personally, I think quite a lot of it is actually just about community. Mm. I think, you know, we tend to live in natural villages. You know, our friends live near us. And I think if you have an association with a product, your vegetables are grown near you, or you know that this particular product was made in the Hebrides or something, it has a greater meaning to it. And I think that gives me quite a lot of hope for British making. And in addition to that, you've got some great success stories like Jaguar Land Rover, absolutely flying, making tons of stuff in Britain. So I think there are good reasons why we certainly haven't seen the last of manufacturing in Britain.
I mean, that was going to be my other question. You know, the made in the UK or made in Great Britain probably has more currency than ever. I think it's such a buzzword at the moment on all sort of levels of the market. But is this actually now a commercial thing? Is money being made in Britain now? Has there been a renaissance in British making?
Yes, I think there has. I mean, at the very top end, I mean, Savile Row is still doing really well. And I mean, I'm absolutely certain it'll still be making bespoke suits in 100 years. Church Shoes are doing absolutely wonderfully with beautiful handmade shoes. I mean, they have production line techniques as well, but there's an enormous amount of handwork that goes into it. So I think at that level, I think it's going to continue. And I think the other thing that is, I mean, working, for instance, in the Geese and Hawks business, which I'm chairman of as well, you've got to consider, you know, if you're getting samples made for production runs, if it's being made far away, it's going to take time. You've got to have people traveling. So there are actually, it's not just about sentiment. I think a lot of it is about, I mean, there's economics. And then the other thing is, you know, the carbon footprint effects of freighting stuff all over the world. So I think the likelihood is that there will be, certainly at the high end, I think there'll be pretty consistent renaissance of making.
To the other end of the spectrum, back to sort of craftsmen.
Yeah.
What sort of, in your opinion, what kind of backing do these craftsmen get from the government initiatives like that? Do you think there's enough support for people?
I think there is. There is some support. And a couple of years ago, the Craft Skills Awards were initiated. And I know that the Crafts Council is increasingly feeling that it has a responsibility towards education and helping guys actually make some money out of it. And there's always been this slight dichotomy between craft and art, you know, and the art seems to get more money and craft is a bit grubby. But I think that's changing. And there's a tremendous amount of interest in apprenticeships constantly. And there are some fantastic award systems. I mean, there's a wonderful charity called Quest, of which I'm a trustee, and we give away about $150,000 a year towards making good craftsmen great craftsmen. And it's just the most incredible. We interview about 50 during the course of the year. And it is really heartbreaking turning anybody down, because the quality of workmanship that is out there is really, really astonishing.
Scattered nationwide? Or
yeah, no, absolutely nationwide. Although it is amazing, actually, how many very good craftspeople there are in London.
Well, that's what I mean, the craft has suddenly become sort of the trendy word, hasn't it? And it's...
Yeah, it's nice to hear it. I mean, we did some soul searching when we named our company the New Craftsman, because, you know, there's kind of a craft. Oh, does that mean, you know, badly made, somebody sitting on the side of the road selling wooden bowls, or what exactly does it mean? But we felt, you know, new is about restating what it means. And to watch somebody who's actually really obsessed with making something perfectly and the use of their hands is just a really extraordinary thing to do. And, you know, you can touch and feel and see the difference between something that's well made. And, of course, you have, you know, remote communities like Orkney, for instance, where you've got the Orkney chair, which has been made for 200 years. We did a wonderful collaboration with a Dalston-based furniture maker called Gareth Neal, with a traditional Orkney chair maker called Kevin Gould, and putting the two of them together and producing a new take on the traditional Orkney chair. And that's actually been our best-selling single product.
Really?
Yeah.
So people's perceptions to craft are changing. It's now sort of become a word like design, which...
I hope it will. I mean, there's considerable interest in the idea of having a craft week. We already take part in London Design Week. And as you may know, there's considerable interest in the idea of a London Craft Week. And if it is done to the same standards of the way in which the London Design Festival is handled, London Design Week, that would be absolutely fantastic.
And are the public sort of willing to pay more now for crafted items as they would be maybe 20 years ago?
Well, I think it's a good time to do it now. I mean, I come from the luxury goods background, and really the luxury goods industry has just risen and risen and risen. And that's not just all about logos. It is partly about the fact that people are willing to pay for better stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, the foundations of the luxury industry was craftsmanship. I would argue that much of it has lost sight of that now. And it's about the logo and about the designer and about the amount of noise that you make. But underlying, there is a demand for better and better and finer things.
So in a way, sort of craft is the new luxury.
I think, absolutely.
Yeah.
The Craft Council had something about 3 years ago called Assemble. And somebody stood up and said, the problem with the luxury goods industry is it's hijacked the craft industry. And I thought, no, stupid. That's entirely wrong. It's just the craft industry is terrible at marketing itself.
That was Mark Henderson, co-founder of The New Craftsman, talking to me there. Japanese architect Shigeru Ban, known most recently as the man behind the cardboard cathedral in Christchurch, New Zealand, has just won the Pritzker Prize, the architecture world's most prestigious. Ban is known for his humanitarian projects and for his use of unusual materials, and he's the second Japanese architect to win in a row, after Toyo Ito nabbed the prize last year. Anna Winston, editor-in-chief of architecture and design online magazine Design, told Tom Edwards why Ban deserves the accolade this year.
I wouldn't say it was the most uncontroversial choice. Usually when you see a Pritzker winner, they've done quite a lot of major public projects, you know, that you could actually go and visit, and he hasn't. So it is quite unusual. It would also have been nice to possibly see a female architect win. Only one ever has, and we've had lots of Japanese architects. So there are pluses and minuses, I would say.
It is always interesting in a sort of award season generally, and with Pritzker Prize in particular, that you get these kinds of analyses, you know, who's been nominated, who's been overlooked. Do you think to an extent they're rather damned if they do and damned if they don't committees, because they'll do something that's maybe a little more radical or a little bolder, and they're criticised for sort of going off the beaten track. But then, you know, the reverse is true. Are they on something of a hiding to nothing, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's very difficult being on a jury for any architecture prize, especially at the moment, because there's all sorts of different things to think about. There's a lot of social conscience stuff. There's a lot of environmental stuff going on. There's an awful lot to think about other than just, do we like their buildings? How well known are they?
And in terms of Ban's architecture in particular, I mentioned at the top of the show, it's a kind of anti-architecture. I mean, it's certainly, he's far away from that awful expression, sort of star architect, as you can get.
Yeah.
And it does certainly, I guess a lot of his work does challenge a lot of traditional preconceived ideas about, you know, what great architecture is. I mean, to that extent, at least, do you think is he a worthy winner?
He's an interesting winner, which I think in some ways, I think that's better because it gives us, well, as journalists, it gives us something great to write about. But I think it also makes us think about what architecture does and what it's for. Ban is known mainly for doing, outside of his temporary structures, he's known mainly for doing private houses, some of which are quite different from the projects that the public might have seen. Mm. He is quite experimental with materials. But I think that these temporary cardboard structures, they really capture people's imagination. And when you do read about these things in the news, I think people just really like them. And I think that there's something to say for that, that they make architecture accessible to the public.
It's interesting you mentioned that thing about sort of domestic, smaller private projects, residential projects perhaps, that idea of the sort of domestic space. Do you think there's still that big divide in a lot of architects' perceptions about, well, you know, to be a Pritzker Prize winner, I need to do marquee projects and they need to be huge public things or infrastructure projects. And, you know, the domestic realm isn't the space to prove that I'm, you know, really one of the sort of big dogs of the field. Or is that a bit of an oversimplification, do you think?
No, that's very much the case. I think that...
Is that a problem? Or do you not think that really matters?
I think it's important that if you win the most prestigious prize in architecture, that the public has an opportunity to see your work. I don't think it's okay for great architecture to be shut behind doors and behind walls all the time. People need to see this stuff. And that's why generally you see the award winners being quite famous, well-known names whose work you can actually go and visit. And I think it's important that people can go and visit it.
And just in terms of what the Pritzker Prize means, obviously there's often this talk about with literary prizes, for example, that it means, you know, your book's going to sell X 100,000 copies and every book you publish for the next 5 to 10 years is going to be a bestseller. Do you see that sort of trickle down with Pritzker Prize? So is it likely that Ban now maybe will be drawn into the slightly more kind of celebrity oriented side of his business? Might he be looking at sort of fighting off some of these bigger commissions? Or is he such a singular thinker that you would imagine he will sort of stick to his guns?
Ban's a really interesting figure, and he's said that winning this prize for him means that he has to do more of this socially conscious work, that he has to keep listening to the public and responding to need. And that's kind of nice to hear. You do sometimes suspect that when people have won big prizes, they get really nice jobs, but they're not jobs that perhaps are as accessible to people. You know, maybe significant bank headquarters, big private companies might look at the Pritzker Prize winner list and, you know, almost as a pre-arranged shortlist for who they want to approach for the next big job. And it's nice to hear an architect actually go on the record and say that they're not interested in that.
So we might watch this space with that one. Just finally, on this idea of sort of, you know, social responsibility and these smaller scale projects, how well a job en masse do you think that, you know, certainly some of the more high profile architects do? There's obviously always a willingness perhaps to engage with projects that are socially responsible, but that are on a very large scale, you know, when you're sort of rubbing shoulders with, you know, big heads of government and this kind of thing. On that slightly more sort of lower level, maybe, you know, what affects more people on a day-to-day basis more frequently? Do they do enough, I think, in terms of not just kind of pro bono projects, but in terms of really looking at things from, you know, maybe the little guy's perspective?
Architecture is a very varied field, and we talk about architects. Architects are very, very different from one to the next, and there are architects out there who are doing some really great work. There are lots of volunteers with organisations like Architecture for Humanity. There's been some very interesting work around New Orleans recently. That's a lot of big name architects getting involved in small projects that can help real people with their everyday lives. It does vary. So, you know, maybe your general domestic architect, of whom there are very many more than these famous names, might not have those opportunities. But there are small things that people can do that do change people's lives, maybe not in a way that we celebrate, and perhaps we should celebrate them. But, you know, things that can save people money on a daily basis in the way that their home is designed, I think that's absolutely as worthwhile in some ways.
Editor-in-Chief of Design, Anna Winston, in conversation with Tom Edwards. After this short break, we'll pay a trip to the Canary Islands. Stay tuned.
Trends come and go, but good design is always essential. At Grundig, people's needs are our core motivation, and that's why we've been pushing the boundaries of engineering to create stylish, high-quality appliances that are improving life as much today as they have been for over 65 years. Grundig. Innovative engineering, timeless design.
This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. We set sail down the Atlantic now to the Canary island of Lanzarote. In the 1960s and 70s, Cesar Manrique was one of the island's most renowned artists, and he used his fame to champion a unique vision for the island's future. Arguing against the rapid development which has characterised much of the Spanish coastline, Manrique outlined a more sustainable construction model to protect the island's singular vernacular. Today, his legacy lives on, and our Liam Aldous flew to the island to visit his first house, carved into the side of a petrified lava field, which has been converted into the Cesar Manrique Foundation. Talking to some of the island's key figures, he asked how one man's legacy has had such a profound effect on the island.
In 1730, on the island of Lanzarote, the Timanfaya volcano exploded into the night, spewing lava into the sky and onto the landscape below. The eruption would continue for 6 long years, transforming the island's topography and its history forever. Over 2 centuries later, a local artist called César Manrique articulated a bold new vision for Lanzarote. Neighbouring islands were already being lured by tourism and the mass construction that came with it. Fearful that his beautiful island would follow suit, Manrique rallied locals behind a more sustainable model for the future.
He thought that tourism was an opportunity to develop, but obviously not at any price. Tourism that destroys the very essence of the island would make no sense. He envisaged something different, a responsible, generous tourism model that incorporated the very essence of Lanzarote, and which could be perfectly integrated into the island.
I'm talking to Alfredo Diaz, the official spokesperson for the César Manrique Foundation, established inside Manrique's first house. It was groundbreaking, both figuratively and literally, exhibiting his new ideas about architecture and built atop a vast lava field with a network of rooms carved into the pre-existing caverns below. This house will be used as the basis for other monuments built around the island. It is now a popular museum, and as we tour the house, common themes and a clear vision become apparent.
This artist's idea, which was absolutely exceptional for the time, was this relationship between art and nature, respect for both the natural and cultural heritage of Lanzarote, while simultaneously not rejecting modernity.
Manrique would later become the driving force for the preservation of the island's unique architectural vernacular, establishing building codes that would respect the island's landscape, impose height restrictions, and would lay out a long-term, sustainable vision for Lanzarote. However, as Alfredo explains, this conservationist vision was also nuanced with modern design concepts.
La construcción, Manrique la entiende como un respeto exterior.
Manrique understood construction as an outward form of respect for the traditional architecture of Lanzarote, a white, understated, integrated, and adapted vernacular. However, his interior design was shaped by extremely modern architectural concepts, and herein lies his message: tradition and modernity can coexist. However, he's also vindicating the idea that we can build in natural areas, not in any way, but with quality builds and by respecting the uniqueness of the place. And the house shows this.
De cualquier manera, se puede intervenir con calidad y respetando la singularidad del lugar, y esta casa lo demuestra.
On the surface level, large windows create an unavoidable dialogue with the exterior, a sweeping, charred landscape that seems almost alien, with a daunting volcano looming in the distance. The fluidity between outside and inside enforces one of Manrique's fundamental ideas, that architecture should be in the service of nature, and that nature should inspire architecture. Below us, a volcanic crater has been converted into an exterior garden, where the crystalline water of a central pool is surrounded by cacti and other native flora. This space would later be repeated on a much grander scale in a volcanic cave and crater that is now known as the Jameos de Agua.
Manrique was fundamentally a pop artist, full of color and joy, and he translated this sentiment continuously into a type of song about the Lanzarote landscape, which is volcanic, arid, and windswept.
We descend a staircase that takes us to the underground level. Here, large natural cavities have been formed by the underground lava. César Manrique has turned these sphere-shaped caverns into a series of lounge rooms. But this idea was not completely novel. Lanzaroteño farmers have been using similar caves to plant special crops for over 2 centuries.
Un pavimento
Here we are looking at pavement whose basaltic forms are part of the natural landscape and were surely taken from somewhere on the island. Here, Manrique integrates them seamlessly into the architecture, meaning that it is nature which imposes itself into the architecture, not the other way around. We've just left the area of the pool with all those sounds you just heard. However, just 2 meters away, we're now in absolute silence. It's only interrupted by the voice of a person who comes in now. Silence is also a part of nature. Manrique embraces silence, and he created fantastic spaces across the island for musical performances and theater, which lay within nature.
The tour ends in the artist's immense studio space, which today stands as a gallery. At the far end of the room, another large window has become one of Manrique's most enduring creations.
Right now, we're looking where the river of lava enters through the window. This is one of the most beautiful metaphors of Caesar's work, that it was nature which served as his inspiration, and that nature paints its very own picture.
Manrique was certainly a visionary of his time, but this doesn't mean he didn't stumble across roadblocks along the way. His sustainable map for Lanzarote's future put him on a collision course with anxious property developers, and at one point there was even a push to declare him a persona non grata.
Why? Because there was a confrontation between two models, and at that particular time, many authorities, including those on the island, were being wooed by a mass development model that would generate a lot of money in a short period. César Manrique faced off against this developer's model, and some authorities decided to try to have him declared as a persona non grata. Why? Because he was a person who openly spoke about these contradictions, about a destructive model and the destruction of an island.
22 years after his death, Manrique's vision remains largely intact, and today politicians are eager to praise the man who has irrevocably shaped the island's modern identity. Manuel Fajardo Feo is the mayor of Lanzarote's capital, Arrecife.
I could not agree with him more, with everything that he's done, because I think where we live and what we have is because of the unique contribution that César made.
Singular que dio César.
Pedro Sanginés is the island's governor.
The
saying goes that no one is a prophet in his own land. This particular proverb doesn't seem to apply on our island, because that's what César was. And we here are enormously proud of his status, his message and his legacy, and strive to keep it alive in our institutions and our people.
However, the legacy of a luminary can sometimes be a double-edged sword, and for many of the island's young architects, it has been difficult working in Manrique's shadow. Ángela Hernández is the vice secretary of the local College of Architects.
We don't need to follow him. We need to find this middle line to be preserving what's preservable and trying to go on with the future and trying to find an evolution. I think he was such different from the rest, and he decided to fight. And the people found in him, in his opinions, a reason to follow him.
The enduring lesson of Manrique's legacy is that one individual can affect such lasting change, but only after a hardly won consensus is forged. And perhaps even more spectacular than his architecture is seeing how yesterday's iconoclast has become today's icon. For Monocle in Lanzarote, I'm Liam Aldous.
This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. If you're a fan of a hands-on approach to furnishing, and your apartment, bedroom or kitchen have become the unwitting hosts to your botched attempts at shelves, tables propped up with books and the like, this one's for you. Because fear not, there's a book out there to help you through the DIY design process. DIY Furniture 2 is the second step-by-step guide from Indiana-based designer Christopher Stewart, this time with bespoke designs from his peers and how-to diagrams to boot. He told Alla John how and why he went about compiling this particular almanac for the domestic designer.
After I got laid off from a couple jobs during the
major downturn in the economy, I started thinking about what I wanted to do on my own. So I started looking towards furniture in ways that I could just kind of tinker. And it meant going to the hardware store and picking up whatever materials I could find at hand and cobbling them together to make something, or at least just to kind of prototype an idea that I had in my mind and flesh it out at full scale. Doing some research, I found online that there were a lot of people like myself doing really similar things. And I thought at first I thought this would make a fantastic art show. And I thought about curating it as an art show and doing a handout with some instructions on how to build some of the pieces. And that really just stuck in my mind as an idea for a great book. So I started looking for people that might publish it. And Lawrence King picked up the idea. Originally, it was just for lighting, and they liked the idea of doing a full furniture book. So that's where we went.
Do you see that there's a kind of growth in interest in this kind of approach to not just to furniture, but to design more broadly, kind of do it yourself, take what you have and, like you say, cobble it together?
I think that it's really catching trend. And I say trend carefully because I don't want to come across that people are doing this to be trendy. They're doing it as a necessity because they might not be able to find exactly what they're looking for. Or they might have an interest in design, but they're trying to figure out they themselves how to get started doing that without having an education or experience in it. So, you know, I think the whole DIY mentality is, it's just that. It's this gung-ho, go-get-em attitude without letting anyone tell you can't do something. So you just kind of go for it.
Looking through the book, Chris, it's set out in a way that a person like myself or someone who's interested in cobbling or tinkering stuff together in their spare time, it's divided into 7 sections. So you got the designs are split into shelves and storage, tables and desks, seating, lighting, bedroom, outdoor, miscellaneous. Why did you divide it into these sections? And how much fun did you have, I guess, is a good question, because the book focuses on works done by other designers and you've given a platform for them to cobble some stuff together. Which is your favorite section? Let's start with.
I don't know that I have a favorite section. We really break the book up into sections just to make it a little more digestible. For the readers, if they're looking specifically for something for the bedroom, they know where to find it. It doesn't necessarily have to be that way. We found that trying to give a balance to the book, it does help to have sections and trying to make sure that you have a certain number of pieces in each section so that you end up with a really well-rounded book. If you were to, say, tackle these projects for your new loft, like yourself, you would have enough pieces in the book from each section to make sure that you had something for your entire loft.
And in terms of approaching the designers, did you give them complete blank canvas? Say, you've got space for, say, a cabinet, or if in the bedroom section is something to do with the bed or the furnishings within the bedroom, did you say, just go for it and tell me what you've got, or were you involved in that process as well?
The book was really curated, much like a gallery show. So most of these pieces existed when I went out looking for them. I did have an open call for entries where I allowed people to submit projects that maybe I wouldn't be able to find on my own. Some of those people maybe even created something special for the book, knowing that it was going to be made specifically for this book. In the end, most of my entries or most of the contributors in the book were found from me doing lots and lots of internet searching. And I actually ended up, this time around for part two, I ended up finding a lot of the contributors through Pinterest, which was kind of interesting. I didn't have that luxury on the first book. So most of these pieces existed by these designers. They created this piece already, many of which were specifically created for retail environments, like clothing racks or desks or something like that for a retail store, maybe a pop-up store or something. And they wanted to create something kind of interesting and exclusive for them, but still try to be a little more affordable with the materials. So that's how I found most of the people.
And out of the projects that you've featured in the book, throughout the sections, I know no one section is your favorite, but which of the pieces do you think kind of represents the best of the philosophy behind this type of design, the kind of do-it-yourself and have a good time and hopefully create something which looks good at the end as well?
Well, that's a tough question. I think for me, I think I gravitate towards what's on the fringe of our DIY future. DIY is so ever-changing. And when you used to think of DIY, especially in regards to furniture, you would think of more on the craft side where people were taking existing mid-century modern designs or some Scandinavian designs that historically performed well throughout history, right? And then people couldn't really afford them, nor could they get their hands on them. So they would make one of these pieces out of plywood or wood from the hardware store. So they were not creating a new design. They were copying an existing design, but trying to create it in a lower cost manner. These books, I have to say this because there has been some confusion about these pieces not being low cost. They're not low cost relative to going to IKEA or knocking off a design from mid-century modern, like a Ray and Charles Ames or something like that. They are affordable if you think that these designers in this book are all heavy hitters internationally. Many of them show in galleries. Their pieces are very reputable in the industry. And for them to give their instructions away on how to make these, that's where the affordability comes from. They are allowing you to put in some elbow grease to make one of their pieces. And by putting in the time yourself, you're saving a little bit of money because, you know, you're putting it together on your own. So to answer your question, the pieces that kind of stand out in my mind in part two as being really embracing DIY are the ones that are kind of on the fringe. So Brandon Keim uses Arduino coating in one of his lighting pieces where as you have two dimmers. One dimmer will turn down all the lights, which is how you think of it traditionally in terms of intensity, and the other dimmer actually turns off certain lights, kind of like maybe a Christmas tree that lights up. And that's done through Arduino coating, which is something really new with DIY. It's definitely more difficult, but it's new. Then there's Studio Swine. They're actually based in London, and they have a chair that it's called the Sea Chair, S-E-A, because they skimmed the bottom of the ocean for remnants of plastic that have broken up and are just sediment on the seafloor. And they filter out the plastic to try to be in light types of plastic, and then they melt it down and form it into a plastic chair. And again, a little more on the difficult side, but in terms of DIY thinking, I really like where that's going.
You talk about where DIY is going. Just finally, what are your thoughts? What would you like people to take from the book?
The takeaway from the book for me would be to not be afraid to get your hands dirty, forward thinking as much as possible, and really, really about embracing design and seeing how if you think about objects and materials in new ways, you can really develop something different, something that you won't find at the store. It's sort of a training manual in a sense. Like by learning from the designs in the books, in both books and the designers that are contributing these brilliant ideas, you'll be like a sponge and these ideas will start to carry through your other work and just the way you approach things in general, not just in terms of design, but in terms of everyday life problem solving. The ability to sort of think around a problem that is normally perceived one way, for example, a zip tie can be perceived as, you know, just a necessity to have around the shop, but it can also hold two boards together or two pieces of plastic, and it can function in so many more different ways if you just let yourself think that way.
Christopher Stewart, designer and author of DIY Furniture 2, in conversation with Alad John. Coming up, we talk the best in Brazilian design and we meet Anish Kapoor.
At Grundig, we are pushing the boundaries of audio engineering to get listeners closer to the content they care about. The Ovation Hi-Fi system brings home big sound in the smallest space. Built with state-of-the-art technology for the ultimate listening experience. Grundig. Innovative engineering, timeless design.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Brazilian Design, Modern and Contemporary Furniture is an exhibition that covers two distinctive periods of Brazilian design, and it's just opened in London. From iconic figures such as Oscar Niemeyer and Sergio Rodriguez, to the more contemporary designers such as the Campana brothers and Zanini de Zanin, the exhibition hosts more than 40 pieces of iconic Brazilian design, with pieces by Niemeyer, Paulo Mendes de Rocha, and lots of others. Our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, went to the opening of the exhibition in London. It's taking place at the Brazilian Embassy until the 9th of May. He spoke to curator and designer, Zanini de Zanin, along with the curator and general project manager, Raul Schmidt Felipe Jr.
My name is Raul Schmidt. I'm Brazilian. I have 55 years old. I'm a collector of art since 30 years. And I started to collect design, Brazilian design, 7 years ago.
Which period is this exhibition covering?
It's covered from the 40s, precisely 47, 1947 is the oldest piece here, up to nowadays.
So you have like classics like Oscar Niemeyer and more current designers as well?
Yes, yes. I have Oscar Niemeyer, Terreiro. We have Zanini Caldas, Zanini di Zanini, is the son of Zanini, Carlos Mota, what else? Many. I have 16 designers here, part modern and part contemporary.
As a collector, of course, you would know that, but what do you think is unique about Brazilian design? Is there a way to define Brazilian design somehow?
No, in a style, because Brazil is a very big country, many regions, and the culture is very diversified, and we can find not one specific style. We have many styles, with it will depend of each region and each design.
If I may ask how during this period that the exhibition is covering, we had this 20 years that Brazil was under a military dictatorship, do you think there was kind of a blockage of design in Brazil during this period? Or do you think there was still things going on?
No, was stuck at us in other creative segments. Everything was stuck in Brazil. We can split in a modern period and a contemporary period. In a specific design, restart with the Campanas brother in the 80s. But the dictatorship in Brazil period was a period of silence in any creative movement, in a theater, with the writers, with everything. And the designers suffer a lot with that.
Do you think Brazil needs to do a kind of maybe a better job in showing their design to the world? Because, I mean, nowadays we talk about Scandinavian design, Italian design, but of course people know Niemeyer, but do you think Brazil should promote more its design around the world, which is something like that you're doing now, actually?
Indeed. For sure, I think that we have today something that is a highlight that no doubt it's Campana Brothers that is helping a lot with the other designs with a very, very strong quality and creativity. But I think that through the state, I think that we should have more incentive to divulge the design. It's not easy to divulge art in any segment. So, but I think that it should happen more often to increment the design, Brazilian design.
I know you showed this exhibition in other cities. Do you know what's the next step? And is there something being shown in Brazil as well, I believe?
Yes. Today, Fernando, we are showing the same exhibition in a bigger space with 7 square meters. And after that, we are going to Brasilia. And from here, we already made this exhibition in Berlin and Lisbon, opened the Brazilian year in Portugal in 2012, and the intention is continuous. I have no hint where we'll be here. I would love to make in Paris, in Vienna, but we have nothing completely tied for that.
My name is Zanini de Zanini Caldas, and I'm a Brazilian designer from Rio de Janeiro.
How relevant do you think is Brazilian design nowadays? Do you think Brazil is managing to showcase its design to the world in a better way?
I can see a new generation very involved and very proud to be Brazilian. This generation, they try to use our information, quality, and also problems. and put those information in their work. This is very unique because we have unique information, unique religion, unique landscapes. And so when we arrive to put and to translate our characteristic, I think we're able to show and to do an important piece, an important work.
That was our very own Brazilian, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, reporting there. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. And finally, we don't often refer you away from the warm embrace of this particular show, but this interview in particular merits some cross-promotion on Monocle 24. The Arklamittal Orbit, or the Orbit to you and I, was commissioned to be London's very own Tower of Babel, an iconic sculpture larger than any other in the UK, and the centrepiece for the capital's Olympic Park during the 2012 tournament. It opens to the public on April the 5th this year. In an interview for Monocle 24's culture programme, I'll let John use this opening as an excuse to meet Sir Anish Kapoor, the cerebral sculptor and designer of the Orbit. Here's a snippet of what they discussed.
A lot has been said about the way your art perhaps straddles the bridge between art and architecture, sculpture and design. Do you see your work as straddling those two spheres? Obviously, your work with Cecil Bauman, those kind of collaborations, they do to a much greater extent. Do you see yourself as both architect and artist?
No, I'm definitely not an architect. I'm an artist, I'm a sculptor, that's fine. However, I'm deeply interested in space. And I've made many quasi-architectural projects, interventions, or whatever you call them. I mean, Orbit, you know, just to cite one, is uncomfortably between both of them. It's not architecture, it's not sculpture, it sort of sits in between. It's about public participation, it's about, you know, the meander up and down it, etc., etc. So in that sense, it is architectural, but actually there's no architectural purpose determined whatsoever, so it's not architectural. I'm interested in the problem of space, you know, the problem of the way we inhabit space, the problem of space as a metaphoric reality, one in which we are hopefully poetically challenged, etc. So, I mean, and it's fundamental to sculpture. Sculpture's about, you know, an object there and an object here, or the relationship in space, a thing's relationship in space, let's say, and our relationship to it. After all, we occupy our bodies in space. So I think these are pretty fundamental to the human condition.
Your collaborator, Cecil Bauman, during the Orbit structure, the design process at least, he said that you and he, during your collaboration, wanted to create a sense of poetry. You mentioned poetry there. There's something poetic about it, the collaboration with the public as well. Do you sense poetry there when you see it now? Or do you...
Orbit?
Yeah, Orbit.
Okay, it's a complicated question, that, because it's an experiential process. Now, Orbit, in many ways, is very, very awkward. It is an object that doesn't... It isn't sleek and linear. In fact, it's the opposite of all tower structures in that sense. It's sort of has its elbows sticking out, as I've often said. I feel that's very important. I feel that's part of this sort of part of the visual tension of the thing. And inevitably, that means that there'll be people who like it and people who hate it and all that. But that's part of the deal. I think that's part of the process of the thing. If all of it was comfortable, I can guarantee you it'd be a non-event. And I think it's the discomfort that it's difficult to provide a language for, except to suggest that it may be that part of it which prompts the most memory, the most poetic memory, if I dare to put it like that, that it reminds you of the innards, of the you know, from Helter Skelter to I don't know, Babel to Tatlin to, it's got little bits that it's none of those and all of those and awkward and why is it there and how does it stand up and, you know, it's not linear, so therefore it doesn't do what structure does. You know, all those bits look like they're going to fall down, it's going to walk off, it's almost animated. So all those things are part of its visual engineering object tension. I think that's what makes it poetic, if there's anything, in that?
Kind of reflected by the awkward nature of the structure, perhaps. Mm. Do you find collaborating difficult and awkward, perhaps? Especially with, I know Cecil Bauman, you've got pedigree with him, you've worked together in 2002. Is that process tricky for you to come as an artist and say, I'm working with a structural engineer?
Cecil and I have worked together for quite a while. We've done various things together. We come at it from very, very different perspectives. Maybe that's important. It's not without tension. I mean, we're good friends, but it's still not without tension. My aim is often to push the engineering out of the way, you know, to say, look, we can do it without seeing the engineering. Here's an object, particularly Orbit, where the engineering is very forward. Now, I felt here that form, engineering, the objectness of the thing, we're all part of what it is. So I can't push it out of the way. It's absolutely there as a thing. So that has its own tension, for sure.
Sir Anish Kapoor there. And you can hear the full interview on Culture via the Monocle 24 website, iTunes, or on SoundCloud. That's all we have time for on today's episode of Section D. Today's show is produced by Aled John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact the producer Aled at awj@monocle.com if you want to feature on the show or if you have any comments or questions. I'm Tom Morris. And to play you out, with the mention of the orbit putting us in a kinetic mood, here's Kate Bush with Moving. Thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye.
As long as you're not